Hello and welcome to our support for inflammatory bowel disease section of the digestion I and E module. What we're going to be looking at today is a really serious inflammatory disease of the intestinal tract. And it's something that Western medicine just really doesn't have any good answers for. It's considered an autoimmune disease, and the standard of care is steroid medication. And at times, when it gets really bad, just cutting out parts of the intestine. That doesn't seem real cool to me. It doesn't seem like the best approach. So let's take a look at how we can approach this from a more natural, holistic way and a much more successful and get to the root cause manner. Before we do that, we want to look at what the underlying causes are and what really is going on in this group of diseases. And before we begin, I want to make sure that you're aware in learning from this presentation and also in working with your clients on this topic that this is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. It's not medical advice. It's just intended as a sharing from me to you, from my knowledge, my research, my clinical experience, and it's meant as education. And the same when you are working with your clients, you're not diagnosing, you're not treating, you're simply providing them with an understanding of the underlying causes and some options for helping them to bring their body back in balance. And in no case should ever you encourage anybody to go off of medication or not listen to their doctor's advice. In every case, we encourage you to encourage your clients to make their own healthcare decisions based upon research, based upon the education that you give them, and in partnership with their qualified healthcare professional. So let's take a look into what exactly inflammatory bowel disease is. It's a group of disorders that cause the intestines to become inflamed. There's several different manners that this can happen, and we're going to be looking at each of those. The inflammation that occurs can last a long period of time and usually comes back and leaves. So it quote unquote goes into remission and then has a flare up. It's estimated that about 1.4 million Americans have some kind of inflammatory bowel disease. So this is rampant in our society. And we'll be looking deeply into why we think that is and what some of the underlying causes are. The two primary ones that you're going to hear about most are Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. There's another one which you've probably heard of too, and maybe not considered in this class, is called diverticulitis, and that's a common inflammatory bowel disease. So let's take a look at what some of the different types of inflammatory bowel disease are, and then we'll get into how we can help people to bring balance back to their colon and help to heal from these diseases. One is ulcerative colitis. And if you look at the photos on this slide, one is of a healthy colon, and you can just see how nice and pink and pretty it looks and smooth. The second picture is of ulcerative colitis, and you can clearly see big patches that are ulcerated, that have, you know, a superficial breakdown of the mucosal lining. The third one you'll see a picture of is Crohn's disease, and Crohn's disease is more of a thickening of the mucosa. It looks quite different from ulcerative colitis, and these pictures, by the way, are a colonoscopy. They're actual photographs from actual colonoscopies. The next one is diverticulitis, and diverticulitis is more of these little folds that happen, these little crevices that develop. They're called diverticuli, and they get inflamed. And you can see in this, it looks like a crater, right? There's a bunch of different craters on the inside of the gut. Doesn't look real comfortable, does it? These pictures, when you compare them to the first one, which is the healthy colon, they look to be quite painful, and in fact, they are. And then the last one is called microscopic colitis, and is actually two different kinds, collagenous and lymphocytic. And those are mainly diagnosed on microscopic examination of the particular types of cells. So let's look at what causes inflammatory bowel disease, then we'll go a little bit deeper into each of them. It can be caused by an immune system malfunction. Many of them are considered, at least Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, are considered autoimmune conditions. They're considered a situation where the body starts attacking itself. So that would be considered an immune system malfunction. It also can be caused by bacterial, viral, or parasitic infections. And we know that these infections do tend to produce toxins that can damage the lining of the intestine. Also, dietary factors play a huge role. We know that the state of the Western diet, at least, is really awful. It's loaded with what's considered non-foods, not real foods, foods that are processed and foods that are high in inflammatory fats, foods that are high in sugars, and in alcohol and caffeine and other things that can actually damage the lining. So under the dietary factors, we look at contaminated foods. I mean, certainly an overgrowth from a bacterial or a viral infection can cause that, or foods that are contaminated with toxins. High fat and high sugar diets. Hydrogenated oils and the oils that are in the processed foods. And hydrogenated oils, as we know from our macronutrients module, that there's shifts in the structure and in the shape of the modules, of the molecules, that actually cause damage to tissues. And they cause oxidation, and oxidized fats create free radical damage. Celiac disease and food allergies, wheat in particular, gluten in particular, tends to wreak havoc on the lining of the gut, and any other food allergies which cause a chronic inflammatory condition. Eating disorders are amongst the causes under dietary. The fact when people binge and then purge or starve themselves, there can be an increased susceptibility to inflammatory bowel disease. The other factors that are huge, stress. Stress, as we know, causes an increase in the hormone cortisol, and cortisol basically shuts down the digestive tract, decreases the protective mucous membrane, and can, in combination with other factors, can lead to inflammatory bowel disease. Smoking, we know that cigarette smoke has tons of carcinogens and chemicals that can cause damage to tissue. Also, a genetic predisposition. Now, I'm of the belief that just because you have a genetic predisposition to something doesn't mean that you're going to develop it. But given the combination of genetic predisposition plus environmental factors and other, you know, toxic exposures and whatnot, that genetic expression occurs that causes a disease. So there's particular HLA factors that are predisposing, particular SNPs that predispose people to Crohn's and ulcerative colitis in particular. Environmental toxins, where there's tons of them in our environment, that can damage the lining. Certain medications have been linked to increased incidences of inflammatory bowel disease, and those include things like oral contraceptives, hormone replacement therapy, and acne drugs. And finally, gastric bypass surgery can be a huge contributor to inflammatory bowel disease. With gastric bypass surgery, the surgery is done to basically cut off parts of the digestive tract, and in doing so, decreases the ability of the body to break down the foods. So if you've got a lot of undigested food matter making their way down into the lower part of the small intestine, the jejunum, and also into the ileum, and then into the large intestine, you're going to get some irritation and aggravation to the lining. So gastric bypass surgery also predisposes to the increase in overgrowth of bacteria in the small intestine because of what's called a blind loop. Those all factors that put together can lead to a causation of inflammatory bowel disease. So let's take a look at how we would evaluate for inflammatory bowel, how you can kind of get a sense of it from symptoms and also in combination with tests that their medical doctors may run. So symptom surveys, really important just to get a sense of what the symptoms related to the gut are. And there's a lot of crossover, as we know, right? There's a lot of conditions that can cause diarrhea, constipation, abdominal pain. But we're looking to put together a symptom picture. And we'll look a little bit bit more closely at how each of the inflammatory bowel diseases will present, so you can get a sense or a suspicion that the person might be dealing with it. A lot of times when people come in to see you, they're looking for an alternative. They've already been diagnosed by their medical doctor, had a colonoscopy, whatever, to confirm it. And they're looking to you to help support them with the proper nutrition and lifestyle habits. But sometimes you're just going to have people that present to you that are looking for nutritional and alternative approaches to just their gut in general. And they may be telling you some vague symptoms. So that's where drilling down to see if you can understand it. And you're not going to diagnose inflammatory bowel disease. What you're going to do is be able to, if you suspect it in someone who hasn't already been to a medical doctor to have it diagnosed, then you're going to suggest that they do that. There's other things that can be helpful. One is blood testing. So just a standard blood test, a chem screen and a CBC can give you some clues as to whether there is a possibility of inflammatory bowel disease. There's a couple of general inflammatory markers. One is called the ESR, erythrocyte sedimentation rate, also known as SED rate. And the other one is the highly sensitive C-reactive protein. And those two are general inflammatory markers. So we don't know for sure if the problem is in the gut. But if we see those elevated and we have some gut symptoms, we're suspicious. Okay, there are more specific tests that you can do. A fecal occult blood test will detect if there's some bleeding going on. In some of the inflammatory bowel diseases like ulcerative colitis, there's very overt bleeding, usually. Not necessarily, but usually. Very overt bleeding from the rectum, bloody stools, bloody diarrhea. In other cases, there may be more what's called occult blood, and the blood would be hidden in the stool. That's especially true in things where it's maybe a Crohn's disease that's occurring further up in the digestive tract. So that's a good test to do. A stool test, something like a Doctor's Data or Genova Diagnostics would, or even Diagnostics, has a really comprehensive stool test, and they have inflammatory markers that you can look for. And you can also look for the presence of parasites in the stool. So some of the inflammatory markers that we look for in the detection of inflammatory bowel disease are things like calprotectin, lysozyme, and lactoferrin. Also in the stool, you might look for the presence of white blood cells and mucus. And if you're seeing white blood cells and mucus in the stool, and you also might be seeing some elevated white blood cells in the CBC, and you're seeing some inflammatory markers, there's a good chance that there's some inflammatory bowel disease. And secretory IgA, which is the immune system reacting in the mucous membranes in the gut, is another clue. So once you've got a picture where you feel like maybe this person has some inflammatory bowel disease going on, there's a number of options, right? One, I think that you owe it to them to have a test done to see if this is actually what it is. The other option is to let them know that this is a possibility. And that if they're open to doing some, you know, major dietary changes, they might start to see a shift. But I really think it's a good idea to let them know that you're thinking that there's a possibility that they have an inflammatory bowel disease and that they should see their physician. So when they get some imaging done, the kinds of things that are done are a contrast x-ray, and that's where they're drinking some sort of a contrast medium. It could be barium or radioactive iodine, and then an x-ray is done. The other thing that's a possibility is a small bowel imaging, and there's things called endoscopies, and there's colonoscopies, and there's barium swallows, and a whole bunch of different things like that. There's a CT scan, a CAT scan, where they can actually look and take sequential x-rays to see if there's anything going on in there. That's not going to be as telling. They're going to see areas that have problems. They may not be able to figure out what exactly it is. An MRI, same thing. And mostly they'll do those with some contrast, where the person would swallow some kind of contrast medium so they could see where it's going. You know, whether it's there are some ulcerations and pockets where this contrast medium is collecting. Endoscopy is an internal scoping of the small intestine. It's oftentimes done through the mouth. There's a tube that's threaded down through the mouth, esophagus, stomach, and then into the small intestine. That can only look at the upper part, though, of the small intestine. It's not going to really see much in the lower part. Things that are happening in the lower part of the small intestine are much harder to detect. The large intestine is easy through a colonoscopy. A colonoscopy is where they thread up a tube, and there's a little camera on the tube, and they're taking actual pictures. And I've got some photos that you can see. Well, we actually showed it on the previous slide, where you can see what it looks like when they do that. And with that, you can actually see the folds, and you can see the mucous membrane. You can see if there's ulcerations or diverticuli, etc. Much easier. And then they will usually, any areas that are suspicious, they're going to biopsy, pull a piece of the tissue out, and then look at it microscopically. A flexible sigmoidoscopy, similar to colonoscopy, only it's not as invasive. It doesn't go as far up and around. The colonoscopy will go up and all the way around through the entire large intestine, all the way to the ileocecal valve. The sigmoidoscopy will just strictly be in the lower part, in the sigmoid, colon, and the rectum. So let's take a look at each of the types, the main types of inflammatory bowel disease, and give you an idea of how you can differentiate them and how you can help them. So in ulcerative colitis, the usual location is going to be the descending colon, the sigmoid, and the rectum, and that would be on the left side of the large intestine. So typically what you're going to see there is inflammation and ulceration on the surface. That's if they've had a colonoscopy done, but that's how it presents. There's going to be thinning of the mucosa, but what they're going to report is blood and mucus in the stools, diarrhea. Sometimes it's just repeated. They'll have this bloody diarrhea 8 to 10 times a day. They never want to be away from a bathroom. It makes traveling and working quite difficult during a flare-up. And they'll get cyclic abdominal pain and cramping. So it's not the same kind of cramping as they might get in a Crohn's disease, where it's like doubling over severe pain, but it's definitely abdominal pain and cramping when it acts up. It does tend to come in cycles. It will be there, it'll last for several months, and then it will subside, assuming somebody takes some action to decrease the causes. They can have rectal pain, and oftentimes there's weight loss, sometimes fever, and oftentimes fatigue because they're losing so much blood. Let's take a look at Crohn's disease. Crohn's disease can happen anywhere in the GI tract, but mostly you're going to see it in the ileocecal area. So the last part of the small intestine and the first part in the large intestine. That's about 50% of the cases. Some other locations might be the large intestine, so other parts of the large intestine, about 20% of the cases there, and just the small intestine, you know, somewhere in the 30% range. It can also happen in the stomach, which is rare, and the mouth and esophagus, which are very rare. But it can happen anywhere in the gut, in the digestive tract. The differentiation between Crohn's and ulcerative colitis is that with Crohn's, there's an inflammation deep in the lining, and the mucosa gets very thick. The type of pain presentation, as I mentioned earlier, is much more severe than ulcerative colitis usually. It's usually a doubling over type of a pain. There's lots of diarrhea, but it's not necessarily bloody all the time. It's not that profuse bleeding, but they will see blood. They report that they'll see blood on the toilet paper or blood in the toilet bowl when they have a bowel movement. It's also more associated with weight loss, fever, and fatigue. Again, the major differentiation in symptoms would be the seriousness of the pain, how much rectal bleeding there is, and the frequency of the diarrhea. But it's not always easy to detect and determine between them unless they have a colonoscopy done. Diverticulitis can happen anywhere, but mostly it's the end of the descending sigmoid colon. So usually it's right there towards the end, but you can see it in any other parts of the large intestine. So it's basically outpouchings. So instead of the, you know, mucosa is usually lots of folds. What happens is there become these little outpouchings, these little holes almost. When you look at the surface, if you look at the picture here, it looks like little craters in the lining of the intestine, the large intestine. Now, when the person just has those craters, it's called diverticulosis. It's when those craters get inflamed and have a buildup of white blood cells and mucus in them that it's called diverticulitis. They're inflamed. What are the causes? Well, it could be due to an infection, and that's a common cause, but a lot of it, they just don't know. There's the same dietary considerations we've talked about before. There's an irritation and a lack of integrity of that mucous membrane. The incidence is much lower in vegetarians, so there may be something in the fats, the animal fats or proteins, that contributes to it. The pain is usually the left lower side just because of the location, but again, it could be anywhere, but usually on the left lower side, and it's persistent. It just is there. It can cause nausea and vomiting. It can cause fever. It can cause tenderness, so if you're palpating or they're touching spots on their abdomen, they're going to notice that. And it can cause constipation and sometimes diarrhea. So to differentiate between the Crohn's and the ulcerative colitis and diverticulitis strictly on the basis of diarrhea, if you're going to make a generalization, you'd say that ulcerative colitis, lots and lots of diarrhea, usually bloody, profuse blood in the diarrhea. Crohn's, definitely diarrhea, could be frequent, not usually as frequent as the ulcerative colitis, some blood in the stool, but not usually as profuse. And with diverticulitis, there's sometimes diarrhea, but that's not one of the main complaints, so you're not going to see it quite as often as you would see it in the other two. And last, let's look at microscopic colitis. It's much, much less common than the other inflammatory bowel diseases. Its location is anywhere in the large intestine. But the thing about it is it's inflammation that's not really visible to the naked eye. You actually see it and can differentiate what kind of cells there are under the microscope. So there's two main types. One is collagenous colitis, which is an accumulation of collagen, which is a structural kind of a tissue, in the epithelium and the connective tissue. And we call this combination of epithelial and connective tissue in the gut the lamina propria. So in lymphocytic colitis, the accumulation is of lymphocytes, which are white blood cells, in the lamina propria, the connective tissue and the epithelium. What can cause it? Well, it could be caused by viral, bacterial, toxic infections, or from medications, very commonly from medications. It's usually benign and short-lived, so it'll happen for a short period of time and go away. Not like the others where, like with ulcerative colitis and Crohn's, it's severe, it lasts a long time, and then it goes away maybe for a short time and then comes back. This is more of a transient kind of a condition. There's watery but not bloody diarrhea, so that's a differentiating point. They will get abdominal pain and cramping, like it's usually more on the lower left side, but it could be anywhere in the large intestine. They'll get some bloating and they'll get some dehydration. So inflammatory bowel disease is dangerous enough in and of itself in that it's messing with the digestive system. It's causing a loss of blood. It's causing people to feel fatigue. It's causing the immune system to be challenged by having to fight and produce these chemicals, inflammatory chemicals. But the more serious consequence is that it predisposes a person to an increased risk of cancer. And so think about the integrity of that lining, and it starts to get broken, and there's a lot of activity, immune activity going on there. And with colon cancer, you start with a first stage of colon cancer, which is just a tumor in the lumen itself, so in the tract itself. In stage two, that tumor starts to invade the underlying tissue, the connective tissue underlying it. In stage three, it actually breaks through the intestine and can cause some leakage into the peritoneal space, the space outside. You can see in the third picture where that tumor has invaded and it's gone you don't still have the margin of the intestinal tract, the underlying intestinal tract in place. And then the fourth is where it breaks out and actually some of the cells get into the lymph and the bloodstream, and that's a stage four. Stage four is much more difficult to manage and get under control. So it's really important that the kinds of things we're going to talk about in a little bit to help people to prevent and manage their inflammatory bowel disease get put into practice early on so that they reduce their risk of cancer. And if there is some cancer going on in there, that it's caught before it gets to be stage four and invading the lymph and the bloodstream. So let's look at management. There's four main pieces to managing inflammatory bowel, and it's not that different from some of the other things we've talked about before. There's diet, lifestyle, herbs, and nutrients. So some of the interventions that have been found to improve inflammatory bowel disease, in addition to the food pieces, which is super important, acupuncture. Acupuncture helps to restore the energy balance and the blood supply and the immune supply to that gut. Chiropractic adjustments, especially if someone has had any kind of injuries or, you know, back pain or anything like that, where there's some impairment of the nerve flow from the spine out to the digestive tract. So adjustments can be very helpful. Again, these are all adjunctive things. You can't just get somebody to get acupuncture or get some adjustments without addressing some of the underlying causes, like boosting the immune system and improving the food, etc., and the stress levels, big. So massage, bodywork, craniosacral therapy, those work dramatically to improve energy flow and also to reduce stress in the body. As do energy medicine, Reiki, magnetic therapy, and EFT. These have all been studied and shown to have some beneficial effects on the functioning of the gut and thus in helping to improve the inflammatory bowel condition. Enemas and colonics can be very helpful in that we're moving stool along. Now, thinking about these inflammatory bowel conditions, oftentimes there's a lot of diarrhea associated with it. So you'd proceed with caution before you'd have somebody who has diarrhea do an enema. But sometimes doing a deeper level of colonic, there's oftentimes some impacted stool further up that can be pulled out, and there's toxic exposure that can do that. The one thing I kind of like is the probiotic retention enema, and that would be where they would do an enema to clear out the gut or clear out the colon, but then have an implant of a probiotic. So probiotic mixed with water, put into the enema bag, and then put it in. You'd only do a few ounces, like anywhere from, 2 to 4, maybe 6 ounces in there, and then they'd hold that. It's a really good idea if they have a long enema tube that they can thread it up a little bit higher so it's not right near the exit, so that they're more likely to be able to pull those probiotic organisms in and allow them to grow. Another thing that's been studied to some extent is fecal transplant, and that's, over the last few years, it's becoming much more well-known and widespread than it ever was before. And it's basically transplanting the stool from one person into another. Now, that doesn't sound real fun. It sounds kind of gross. But on the other hand, think about the organisms that a healthy person has in their gut versus someone who does not have a healthy environment. And it can really help to restore the immune and the microbiome colonies in the gut. So let's look at some of the lifestyle habits. Well, it's been found that when people do food diaries, they tend to control their food much better. They tend to eat less. They tend to eat more healthfully. So having someone do a food diary, it also helps you to be able to see like when their flare-ups are happening in regard to the food that they're eating. So it's important that you do not just a food diary, but I have people do a food and symptom diary. So if you find that they always are worse after certain meals, then you're narrowing it down to the foods that are really aggravating them. Certainly, we want everybody to avoid smoking. That goes without saying, but the toxins in the smoke have been known to damage the lining of the gut. Walking and other low-intensity type exercise is good. Oftentimes, folks with inflammatory bowel disease also have stressed adrenals, so you don't want to get them into some super heavy-duty exercise, but walking and some burst training and other things like that can be really helpful. Certainly, any kind of activities that are damping down the sympathetic nervous system and helping them with the parasympathetic nervous system are going to be phenomenal. And most people that get inflammatory bowel disease have had some sort of a stress on their system in the time before it occurred. So heart math, biofeedback, yoga, meditation, relaxation and breathing techniques, these are all amazing things that you can support your clients in doing and learning to do. They don't have to do all of them, but there's enough to choose from that they can pick one that really does get them into that relaxed state to help to calm and soothe and heal. And then finally, removing environmental toxins, just really going through with them and looking at the kinds of things they're putting on their skin, the kind of things they're using to clean their homes, to clean their bodies, to freshen their air. It's really important to go through and eliminate the toxins from the system. So let's look at some dietary habits. A lot of the same dietary habits we've talked about for other gut conditions apply here to inflammatory bowel disease. Bottom line is they have to be eating well. You cannot keep throwing fuel onto the fire. And when somebody has an inflammatory bowel disease condition going on, you really, really need to be careful about what they're eating and what they're throwing onto the fire. Think about inflammation as a fire. And if you're putting caustic materials on a fire, you're putting fuel on that fire. You can't put it out. So dairy and gluten at the minimum are the first starting points that I will work with. Also, anything at all that they're allergic to, you think they're allergic to, they think they're allergic to. I usually just use the top six allergens and then question them about what kind of foods do they crave? What kind of foods do they feel like they could never live without? What are their trigger foods? What are the foods they eat a lot of? And those are good suspects to start to pull out in terms of allergens. Eliminating refined carbohydrates and sugars, again, they feed the bad gut bacteria. They cause spikes in insulin. They cause spikes in the various and sundry bacteria that are not beneficial. Plus, they're devoid of all the nutrients. We really need to have good nutrient sufficiency because these diseases are affecting the body's ability to absorb nutrients. So it's super important. I would also be making sure that they're, in addition to eliminating the refined carbohydrates and sugars, that they're eating foods that are high in nutrient value. But we have to be careful with them on fiber. Because fiber put over a broken up, an ulcerated gut lining is going to cause problems. It's going to cause pain. It can cause aggravation. So we have to find this balance there. Nightshades in many people with Crohn's disease can be very helpful. And at least a trial of 2 weeks of elimination of nightshades can be very helpful. I like to put people on an all-liquid diet for as long as I can get them on it, hopefully 2 to 4 weeks. The reason is that they've got ulcerations in their gut. They've got inflammation in their gut. And if you just keep putting food through that, face it, nobody really chews to liquid. We chew too fast. We don't get it down to liquid. And you're getting a lot of fibrous pieces that can impair the gut lining. So I'm a big fan of trying to get them on an all-liquid diet. Now, what that can be just depends on the person, depends on how much they weigh, it depends on their openness to try new things, but an all-liquid diet could be what's called an elemental diet, where we just give them like a powdered drink mix. And you could use some of the commercially made ones, but you can help them to put together their own with a combination of protein powders and maybe some green powders. And you take into account their preferences, you take into account their allergies, you take into account their blood sugar. But it's really important that you help them to design a diet that would work for them. So an elemental diet, green juice, and oftentimes I'll do green juice with some protein powder in it to fortify it, because the gut lining needs protein to heal. And getting steak and eggs is not the best protein source because that is very difficult to break down and can make the problem worse. So I like to give them plant-based proteins and lots of micronutrients in the form of green juices, green powders, blended cooked vegetables. The one thing I would avoid here is the foods that are high in insoluble fiber, the foods that are high in cellulose, and that would include some of the grains and also raw vegetables. As a big a fan as I am of raw vegetables in the diet, I think that while you're trying to heal Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, you need to eliminate that for a while, and you need to just get them on blended cooked foods or juiced raw foods, and you can supplement that with some protein powders to help to heal. They need omega-3s. They absolutely need omega-3s. Now, you got to be careful of flax and chia seeds unless it's the oil or you've soaked them and created a gel and then blended it. The problem is if some of those seeds escape unchewed or unblended, they can be irritants to the inflamed gut lining. So if you're using flax or chia seeds, I recommend you soak them into a gel and then you blend them and just see how they do. They can do really, a lot of people do really well with that because of the demulcent quality of both of those seeds plus the omega-3s, which are anti-inflammatory. But you do have to be careful not to aggravate and go slow with people. If they say, hey, that food aggravates me, you pull that food out. You don't argue with them and say, well, that shouldn't because nobody else with Crohn's has that problem. You take it out and then you can always add it back in or add it back in a different form. They should be eating relatively small meals, which is why I think blending is so good, and easy to digest foods. So it's a good idea to have them do some digestive enzymes, and if you can get them to do that, blend up the food, put some digestive enzymes right there in the food so it's with the food, and then take those foods in. They have to chew well. And if they're not blending everything, they really do need to chew well. So I am not a fan of allowing people with Crohn's disease during the early healing stage or ulcerative colitis to be eating salads and a lot of raw vegetables. So, you know, if they're blending them, some of them do really well if you blend them as a smoothie, usually if you put some sort of a thickener in them, so say blended with chia seeds or blended with some coconut or blended with avocado to make it smoother on the gut. It's really important that they stay hydrated, and it's hard when people are having diarrhea to think about drinking because they're afraid it's going to go right through them, but all the more reason, right, because they're losing a lot of fluids in the diarrhea and they need to have water. So I would have them sip water, you know, use a straw, use a cup with the little lid, not to just gulp down water, but to stay hydrated throughout the day. Mineral broths are really good as well, so steaming vegetables and using the broth from that, or deliberately making a mineral broth where you put a lot of really high mineral vegetables in the pot, you cook it up, and then have them drinking the broth. They could be sipping that broth throughout the day in addition to or instead of water to try to help get all the nutrients, the healing nutrients in them. Avoiding all the stuff we know not to eat, right? Sodas, caffeinated beverages, and fruit juice. Some folks with ulcerative colitis and Crohn's do really well on the softer fruits. So especially if you're working with somebody who's underweight, which a lot of these folks are, if you can't put them on too low a calorie diet. So the fruit can be okay. You just have to play it out and see how it works with their blood sugars and also if they have candida. But never fruit juice. Fruit juice is just way too much sugar for their guts to handle, and it can cause a diuretic effect. So let's look at some of the anti-inflammatory herbs, foods, and nutrients that help heal. We've looked at these before. It's a matter of finding amongst these the ones that are going to do well for your client. Are they willing to take teas? You know, ginger and turmeric as teas or as juices can be really wonderful. Are they willing to take tinctures? So looking at this list, ginger and turmeric are phenomenal, but not everybody tolerates them well if they've got some disruption to their gut and ulceration. It may trigger pain, so I'd go really slow with introducing those. Licorice can be real good, but again, you have to watch for precautions of the blood pressure. So if they have high blood pressure tendencies, you don't want them to do that. Chia seeds, flax seeds are really great, and hemp seeds, but I would make them into milks. You can make flaxseed milk or chia seed milk, and that would be soak them and then blend them up, and they can add some flavors that work well, some of these other herbs that work well, like cinnamon and things. Deep ocean fish is a good source of omega-3. Again, make sure it's not something that has bones in it. Make sure that it's really soft when they're eating it. Algae and sea greens are really good source of omega-3, so I would, you know, make sure that they're getting some of that in their diet if you can get them to tolerate it. Purslane, which is a wild green that is very high in omega-3s, and it has a mucilaginous kind of a thing, and blending it up or juicing it or putting it into smoothies could be very helpful, or soups. So you can make a cooked vegetable soup, and then you could add some purslane blended up in there. And you can combine the two. You just have to find each person's tolerance level. It's going to take some work in dealing with somebody with Crohn's or ulcerative colitis or diverticulitis, because you've got to go slowly with and find what they tolerate. Vitamin C can be helpful, but again, you've got to be careful because of the issue with the diarrhea. So vitamin C might trigger diarrhea if they're at their bowel tolerance. It may not have any effect on diarrhea if they're not at bowel tolerance. So that's something to look at. Omega-3 fats in the form of fish oils or algae oil, very good for them. Bromelain and other proteolytic enzymes can be very helpful. But again, you check to see how they feel, because sometimes proteolytic enzymes can aggravate an ulceration. Another thing, again, you have to test, see how they feel. Capsaicin in peppers is this amazing, amazing constituent that helps with healing mucous membranes. The problem is it may not feel so good on the mucous membranes. So it might be something that you can incorporate into a tincture, or you can maybe mix with some aloe vera gel or some other things that are more mucilaginous. But again, find their tolerance level. And then some of the herbs that are just common herbs that are in most people's herbal rack, which would be cinnamon and rosemary and basil and cardamom and chives and cilantro, cloves, those are all, and garlic, those are all good. But again, tolerance. Don't just give them a whole bunch of them and say, here, do this. Try them one at a time and see how they work. And then parsley is another one that it can be blended into soups. It can be juiced. Parsley can be really helpful. I want to talk about two specific herbs that are really helpful. One, Boswellia. There have been a ton of studies that link Boswellia with improved function of in Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. I've worked with Boswellia. I've worked with, have people take Boswellia tinctures for various inflammatory bowel diseases and had phenomenal results. So Boswellia is a really good one, as is quercetin. Quercetin is a bioflavonoid, and it very high in things like onions and garlic. And it's really, really helpful as an anti-inflammatory agent. The demulcents, we've looked at these before. They soothe the GI tract. They help the mucus layer to rebuild. They have some anti-inflammatory capabilities. They lubricate the digestive tract, and they nourish the fluids and the tissues. So you can see that that would be a really important part of your protocol for helping somebody soothe their inflamed bowel. So some of the ones we've already talked about, like chia seeds and flax seeds and licorice, they're very good demulcents. Lots of studies been done on licorice in terms of its healing capabilities. More of the studies are done on licorice for healing ulcers in the stomach, but it's been studied for other areas. Marshmallow and slippery elm, those are very demulcent. Some people who have also a combination of, say, inflammatory bowel plus a SIBO might have some problems. You'd have to check them out and see if they have some SIBO or some sensitivity to the FODMAPs. And we'll be talking a lot more about SIBO and FODMAPs in another presentation. Comfrey, don't recommend you use very much of it. It's sometimes good in extreme cases for very short period of time, but it has what's called pyrrolizidine alkaloids that can be harmful to the liver. So you just have to be careful. Irish moss I mentioned because you can get Irish moss as a whole sea vegetable and then soak it and have them turn it into a gel, and that can be added to a lot of things. It can be added to yogurts and puddings and all kinds of things that are nice and soft. You do want to watch for it. Do not encourage them and discourage them from using Irish moss as a powder. And the reason is that when somebody takes the Irish moss as a powder, that powder is going to start to absorb some more of the fluids, and it's going to absorb fluids in the gut. It can get caught into the small intestinal folds and the microvilli and actually start to expand and puff out there, and it's been linked to cancers when you use it that way. Carrageenan similarly. So just be careful with those. Irish moss as a whole herb soaked and then made into a gel can be just fine. So play with caution there. Cinnamon is, in addition to being anti-inflammatory and carminative, it's good demulcent. So is chamomile and fenugreek. Jujube dates are something that we mostly don't use here in the States, but it's very common in China. And they don't taste like our dates. They're not as sweet as our dates, but they're very good demulcents. So a lot of the Chinese formulas will use jujube dates. Aloe vera gel, best if it's aloe vera gel straight from an organic aloe vera leaf out of a plant. But you can also get some of the ones that are extracted, but know that they usually break down pretty quickly. Plantain is another one. You can grow it in the backyard. It's a wild edible, and it's very, very soothing and demulcent. And that can be blended into some of the juices or the soups and whatnot that you tell people to make, but also it can be done as a tea. And calendula and yarrow, similar. They're very good for stopping bleeding. Yarrow in particular is very good for stopping bleeding. So yarrow can be used. Yarrow can even be used in an enema situation where it goes up into the colon and can be very helpful. So this concludes our presentation about inflammatory bowel disease. There's a lot more to learn about it. I wanted to give you an overview and give you some starting points for working with people with it. I've given you access to some videos here that are on YouTube that are actually quite they're quite good to see, because you get to see what's going on the endoscopy or the colonoscopy. So the first one is Crohn's disease in the terminal ileum, and that's an endoscopy. Colonoscopy with diverticulitis and a polyp. Colonoscopy of Crohn's disease. There's a colonoscopy of ulcerative colitis, and they're all really short. You just get a sense of what it looks like. But I found this one video that I really enjoyed, and it's very entertaining. The doctor that's teaching it is very entertaining. He's teaching it to a live audience, and there's some slides. But he goes through some overview of digestion and also inflammatory bowel disease, and he kind of pokes fun at the conventional approaches to it. And so I really enjoyed that, and I think you might too. I think the more you really delve in and understand how all this works and what all the pieces are, you understand what the protocols are. And on the one hand, you can say, okay, what can we do that's natural to treat or help people manage their inflammatory bowel disease? And if you do that, I could have made, you know, a very short presentation to just give you that. But I think it's much more valuable if you understand what's going on and you can have a picture in your mind of what's going on, which is why I recommend that you watch these videos. So thanks so much. This is Dr. Rita Marie, and we'll see you on the next one.